You're listening to The Music Show on RN. Now it's time to talk about A Survivor from Warsaw. It's a piece composed by Arnold Schoenberg in 1947, and it's the subject of a book by Joy Calico. And in particular, it's the reception of this piece that is the subject of the book. We'll talk to her in a moment via Skype. This is how the piece begins.
Most of the time. I remember only the grandiose moment when they all started to sing as if prearranged. The old prayer they had neglected for so many years, the forgotten creed. How I got underground to live in the sewers of Warsaw for so long a time.
And that is how the piece begins. Schoenberg's A Survivor from Warsaw, that particular recording conducted by Robert Kraft, the London Symphony Orchestra, and the narrator, the actor Simon Callow. It's not that usual for a book to be devoted to one piece of music, and it's very unusual for it to be devoted to a piece of music in terms of its almost immediate reception, but that is what Joy H. Calico's book does. Arnold Schoenberg's A Survivor from Warsaw in Post-War Europe. Joy Calico is Associate Professor of Musicology and Director of the Max Cade Center for European and German Studies at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. But she joins us now from Berlin by Skype. Joy, welcome to The Music Show.
Thank you, Andy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's talk first of all about the composition of this piece, 1947. How did A Survivor from Warsaw come about?
Schoenberg had, once he came to the United States, he was from a distance, mostly in California, very invested in Zionist politics, very worried about what was happening to Jews in Europe, and this was something he was constantly thinking about, hearing about from survivors who were coming to the United States. And an idea like this had been rolling around in his head. A choreographer had spoken to him about a project. None of these things had really coalesced. And then when the Koussevitzky Foundation approached him with the commission, he said, "Oh, I've already been thinking. I have a piece in mind." They said, "Great. You know, at this point, Schoenberg can do what he wants. Essentially, this is pretty late in his life. He's very well established, and so he writes this piece, only about 7 minutes long, that is to commemorate what happened to the Jews in Europe during the 1930s and 40s." And it's a pretty extraordinary piece. These are very early days for Holocaust commemorations of any kind, literary, musical, what have you. And so it's a pretty extraordinary undertaking for 1947.
It is. And the use of the narrator is fascinating in many ways. The text is Schoenberg's own, and it's written in English. But there is a German officer who speaks in German, and then at the very end, this male voice choir which arrives.
Right, and they're singing in Hebrew, so you have this trilingual piece, if you will. And the English is interesting to me. I mean, it's certainly understandable, but it's not idiomatic. I mean, I think it would sound to a native English speaker like an immigrant or like a survivor, somebody who speaks English but not naturally, perhaps. And I'm not sure Schoenberg realized how unidiomatic his English was, but I think to native speakers it sounds like the way someone might speak if they were telling the story in a second or third language. And then the quotations, when the survivor in question, the narrator, is remembering what happened, those are spoken in German as part of, you know, this kind of flashback or this traumatic memory that he has. And then, of course, when when he remembers the choir, then the men singing as they go to their deaths, they're singing the Shema in Hebrew.
And the artificiality of the narration, of course, is exacerbated by the way in which Schoenberg notates it. And what we heard Simon Callow do then was a rather naturalistic version of, and not a particularly accurate version of what Schoenberg has written in the score. But Schoenberg has, for the most part, notated the rhythms very precisely. And although it's written on a single line, he has a sort of go at relative pitches as well by putting notes above and on and below the line and sometimes on ledger lines and even occasionally with sharps and flats, although I have no idea what that could possibly mean.
Well, I think you've hit upon the challenge for the narrator and how to perform this. And this goes, probably the most famous example of this kind of vocal production for Schoenberg is in his piece Pierrot Lunaire from 1912. But that's notated on a full staff. And so that gives a much bigger vocal range. It looks, and even in most performances, sounds more sung. But you're exactly right. By the time we get to A Survivor from Warsaw, he's notating this kind of inflected speech on a single line and then moving above and below it, again, as you say, with some sharps and flats, but to give relative pitch, sort of to outline gesture, where the stress, the word stress, the rise and fall of the voice would come. But you're absolutely right, the rhythm is extremely precise.
Before we get to the meat of your book, which is essentially the way in which the piece was received in post-war Europe, let's listen to a little more of it. And we're going to hear a recording conducted by Giuseppe Sinopoli. This time the narrator is John Tomlinson, the great bass baritone and Wagnerian, and he almost sings the piece.
Rivale, when it still was dark. Get out! Whether you slept or whether worries kept you awake the whole night, you had been separated from your children, from your wife, from your parents. You don't know what happened to them. How could you sleep? The trumpets again! Get out! The sergeant will be furious! They came out, some very slowly, the old ones, the sick ones, some with nervous agility. They fear the sergeant, they hurry as much as they can, in vain. Much noise, much too much commotion, and not fast enough, the Feldwebel shouts, Achtung, still you standen, da wir small, oder soll ich wieder dir können nachhelfen? Na gut, wenn ihr es durchaus haben wollt. The sergeant and his subordinates hit everyone, young or old, strong or sick, guilty or innocent. It was painful to hear the groaning and moaning. I heard it though I had been hit very hard, so hard that I could not help falling down.
And there's another section from A Survivor from Warsaw by Schoenberg, a piece composed in 1947, just a very short piece, almost in a way a miniature, though it hardly seems like one. It's the subject of a book by Joy H. Calico. It's called Arnold Schoenberg's A Survivor from Warsaw in Post-War Europe. And Joy Calico is talking to us via Skype from Berlin. Joy, this is a piece which, as you've said, obviously directly addresses the subject of the Holocaust and does so only 2 years after the war ended, a subject about which a number of European countries were in deep denial still. It's also a piece of 12-tone modernism. It's the work of a Jew at a time when anti-Semitism is still quite rife throughout Europe, and it includes the Shema Israel at the end. And it's written by an American citizen in Hollywood, of all places. So there are lots of reasons why it might be a difficult piece to program in Europe in the years just after it was composed.
Yes, indeed. It seems, I think, to people who were not necessarily advocates of Schoenberg's in Europe, it seemed calculated to irritate every exposed nerve of the post-war period, all of these things you list. And these things, what was interesting to me about looking at the way the piece circulated through post-war Europe, be it in the Soviet bloc or in the West or in Austria in the 1950s, which is politically neutral, but certainly not Schoenberg neutral, the same themes do come up over and over again. There is, as you say, this real anxiety and discomfort about Jews, about what had happened to them, about their continual presence in Europe, about the presence of Nazis, former Nazis, both reformed and unreformed in some cases, about 12-tone music, if you're worried about aesthetics and the state of art in the post-war period when it seemed as if art might not survive at all. Is 12-tone the way people want art music to go? There are, for many of these countries, and not just West Germany, which would be the most obvious, this concern about the American occupation, the American presence in post-war Europe as being a very strong and even oppressive presence to some extent. So all of those things, what I found as I was following the piece around Europe was that the piece was a good prism, a good lens through which to read the way that the zeitgeist of Europe in the 1950s and into the mid-1960s, because all these anxieties seem to be magnified through the reception, through the experience of this piece.
Let's talk, perhaps, we can't talk about each of the premieres, but let's talk about the first performance of the piece in Austria. This, after all, is Schoenberg's own country.
Right. This was Hermann Scherchen was the conductor, an enormous advocate for Schoenberg since 1912. They had shared conducting duties on a tour of Pierrot Lunaire. And Scherchen was very committed to new music by lots of people, but certainly he was in close contact with Schoenberg. And he said, I'm going to play a concert on this new music series in Vienna in 1951. I'd like to do a survivor. And he writes to Schoenberg about this, and Schoenberg is not immediately persuaded. He had a love-hate relationship with his hometown. I mean, the Viennese press had treated him terribly while he had lived there. His professional opportunities there had been effectively torpedoed by an anti-Semitic faction. In fact, the Berliners treated him much better than the Viennese. And despite the fact that he had been given honorary citizenship in the city of Vienna after the war, there were efforts to establish a kind of rapprochement with Schoenberg. He was ambivalent about it. And so he was ambivalent about Scherchen performing this piece. To me, one of the more interesting aspects of that performance is that the narration was given in German. There's precedent for doing the narration in the language of the audience, because when René Leibowitz gave the European premiere in Paris, he and Schoenberg had some correspondence about the language, and Schoenberg said, yes, you should do it in French. The narration should be in the language of the audience so that they understand the story. They know exactly what has happened. So the German translation that was used for the Viennese performance in 1951 was actually done by a man named Max von Winter, who it turns out had been a member of the Nazi party, had applied to be a member of the SS, was clearly a committed member of the party. So this is one of the ironies of post-war Europe, that you have former Nazis, Holocaust survivors, people who had been in exile, remigrants, all circulating in the same space, all trying to, you know, just get on with their lives in some fashion.
And a certain,
it's pretty extraordinary.
Quite extraordinary, but also there was a certain amount of censorship really went on in that translation of von Winter. The reference to the gas chambers went, didn't it?
That's right. Yes, that explicit German quotation that should say there's a point where the German soldier is supposed to say in German, "I need to know how many of you. I need you to count off so I know how many I am delivering to the gas chamber." And in this translation, it's just, "I need to know how many I am delivering."
Yes, but it's not the translation, because Schoenberg had actually written that bit in German. So.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So in this version of the text, you're right, they cut the most explicit, the most graphic part of this. And the text is very different in style. I mean, I had said earlier that Schoenberg's English text is very unidiomatic. It's not poetic. And this one is extremely high German. It's very high literature style. So it seems calculated to appeal to a certain aesthetic for the audience they anticipated at this event. I also think it helps. This is, you know, one of the stories of post-war Austria is that they were able to claim first victim status based on something the Allies had said in the early 40s. And so it's as if this was a moment when an Austrian audience could say, "Oh yes, the Germans did terrible things. They did terrible things to us as well." And they could sort of go along with this as if they had played no part in it.
Yes. Let's now move to East Germany, where there is a very different sort of political situation, and it's possible for an East German audience to read A Survivor from Warsaw as an anti-fascist statement.
Absolutely. This is one of the more extraordinary, well, I say this about all of them. I felt like in each context, there was something I, perhaps in my American naivete, had not anticipated. In this case, A Survivor from Warsaw, the first time it's played in the Soviet bloc at all is in 1958 in East Germany. It couldn't have happened much before that because you don't get the thaw until after that. So Stalin dies in 1953. There's this gradual loosening. In 1956, there seems to be a signal from Khrushchev that, you know, this will be sort of a kinder, gentler Soviet bloc, if you will. And in 1958, Herbert Kegel was a very young hotshot conductor with the Leipzig Radio Symphony Orchestra, and he asks to program this piece. And certainly, given the layers and layers of bureaucracy, had anybody wanted to prevent it, they could have. But the fact is, the piece was done in its entirety, in its original languages, without any interference. And so this was fascinating to me, and I began to investigate. And it turns out that the ruling party, the Socialist Unity Party in East Germany, its critics, its reviewers, and their official press just don't say anything about the Jews being part of the story. It's entirely about resistance to the Nazis, which is something that the East Germans had been saying about themselves for a decade already. So for them, it was very easy to get behind the political message of this piece. They just don't note that the victims in this piece are Jewish and that there is Hebrew.
Yes.
They managed just to not mention that.
So again, nothing to do with us.
No, right. We would also have been opposed to the fascists and the Nazis. This is, you know, and fortunately for us all, the former Nazis have ended up in West Germany, right? This was the story.
That's right.
Clearly not true, but that was the story.
You talk about performances in West Germany, in Norway, in Czechoslovakia, but we have to talk about Poland, of course, because here is a country which, before the Second World War, was home to 3.5 million Jews, and by the end of the Second World War, the number was down to 86,000. And by 1958, when A Survivor from Warsaw was performed there, there were 41,000 remaining because a lot had left. And A Survivor from Warsaw is a huge success.
This is one of the things I loved about this project once I started to put these things together. So this East German ensemble, Herbert Kegel's group from Leipzig, participated in the Warsaw Autumn Festival in 1958. So just a few months after the premiere in East Germany, they took this piece on the road to an international music festival, which would not be that unusual if it weren't for the fact that it happened in Warsaw. So you have Germans who take a piece about the German destruction of the Jews to the city for which the piece is named, and they perform this piece. It struck me as almost unbelievable. And I interviewed some people who were involved in that performance, and they all thought of it as an anti-fascist statement, that we are resistant to fascism, the Poles were resistant, you know, this is all something we have in common. And again, not a lot of explicit reference, certainly between the official press, between the East German and Polish official media, not a discussion of what had happened to the Jews. Because the other thing you have to remember is that it's true that the Germans had destroyed the Warsaw Ghetto, but they had also destroyed the city of Warsaw. So there's a little bit of slippage there in the way it's described, and that it's quite easy for people to think that it could have, you know, the term survivor didn't necessarily mean what it means for us today, which I think most people think, if you think of a European survivor from this period, you're talking about somebody who survived the Holocaust. But in fact, Central Europe is full of survivors of some kind or other in
and it is,
the mid-20th.
And the title is A Survivor from Warsaw, not A Survivor from the Warsaw Ghetto.
Right, right. So there's a little bit of slippage there. And there is official press in which the Poles say we accept this performance as an apology, or as a token of regret, this kind of thing. As if it could be read as, for having destroyed the city. And certainly, I suspect, this is a token extended on behalf of the former Germans, right? It's not as if the East Germans are saying, we have done this. It's the previous Germans. But I think it's a couple of reasons. It's extraordinarily successful there. It's an international audience. You have people from, it's only the second Warsaw Autumn Festival, but the Warsaw Autumn Festival is an extraordinary new music festival. It's the only thing like it in the Soviet bloc at this time. And so you have an international audience, but you also have a lot of Poles who are present at this concert. And the rest of the East German, everything else on the concert was by East German composers, and the Poles all thought they were hopelessly backwards and conservative, but that this was a piece that was musically interesting to them and had a very powerful message. So it was very well received. They didn't like anything else on the program.
They had to play it twice.
That's right, yeah. That's right. And this is a strange thing that has happened. In fact, it happened at the very first performance in Albuquerque, New Mexico, in the United States. Kurt Friedrich, the conductor, played it once, turned around, the audience seemed sort of stunned, and he said, would you like to hear it again? And then they played it again, and that happens not infrequently. I haven't seen it done in recent years, but in this period it was not infrequent, because it is so short, and it's very intense and hard to program. And what do you follow that with? And so sometimes I think they think it makes sense to do it twice.
Yes, that's right. And you actually devote some space in the book to discussing what you put with it, because it's turned up on the same program as Beethoven's Ninth Symphony several times. And I like the fact that you refer to one performance where it followed Beethoven's Ninth. It didn't go before it.
I think the effect must have been very different.
Yes, I think so too.
Yes. Although that also breaks one of the cardinal rules of concert programming, which is, the story is always you never put Schoenberg last because people will leave before.
Yes, but particularly after the Ode to Joy, to put this, I mean, it wouldn't send you home with a spring in your step, would it?
No, exactly. That's, I think, one of the criticisms that has come up about normally when the piece is performed with Beethoven's Ninth, the Schoenberg is first, and then you launch into the Ninth. And this is the standard interpretation of that is, yes, there was this horrible thing that happened, but look, we have this greater universal humanity, and here's an example of what is possible. But the cynical part of me says we have 7 minutes of Holocaust and 75 minutes of German triumphalism, right? This seems like not a fair balance. Although, Michael Gielen in the 1970s inserted a survivor between the third and fourth movements of the Beethoven Nine.
That would have been a concert to be at.
Can you imagine when there's not even supposed to be a break? It's supposed to be continuous, and was a way of drawing attention to that strange practice that had already developed of beginning with Schoenberg and then following with sort of the tonic of the Beethoven Nine, something to take the edge off.
The book is called Arnold Schoenberg's A Survivor from Warsaw in Post-War Europe. It's written by Joy H. Calico, to whom I've been speaking via Skype from Berlin. She's Associate Professor of Musicology and Director of the Max Cade Center for European and German Studies at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. Before we finish up, we're going to listen, Joy, to a complete performance of this 7-minute work, A Survivor from Warsaw by Schoenberg. What are your feelings about it, having written the book? I mean, what are your personal feelings about this piece now, as a piece of music?
This is, you know, questions about the aesthetics and the ethics of this piece have been part of its reception since the very beginning. I mean, some of Schoenberg's closest friends said to him already in 1948, I have some misgivings about using the Holocaust as the subject of art. Or I have, you know, even his closest friends, and never mind people who think it sounds like a B-grade movie, you know, that it sounds like a movie score, what have you. My response to those criticisms is that it's 1947. There is no established vocabulary, be it verbal, musical, or visual, for talking about this thing that has happened. And that Schoenberg is doing the best he can with the resources he has, which he, expressionist musical gestures, the 12-tone method, the rituals of concert going and of the Shema, to somehow commemorate the horror of what has happened. And I do think there are times when I listen to it and I think, yeah, it might have crossed over into something that is too sentimental. But I also think it's an incredibly powerful statement for its time period.
It certainly is. Joy, thank you very much indeed for talking to me. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, and it was a pleasure to read the book. It was beautifully written and full of things that I didn't know about. It's called Arnold Schoenberg's A Survivor from Warsaw in Postwar Europe by Joy H. Calico, and it is published by the University of California Press. We're going to listen now to a complete performance of A Survivor from Warsaw. The narrator is Günter Reich, the German-born Israeli singer, and he is narrating it along with the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Pierre Boulez, and the BBC singers will turn up at the end to sing the Shema Israel. BBC Symphony Orchestra and the BBC singers were conducted by Pierre Boulez in that performance of Arnold Schoenberg's A Survivor from Warsaw, and the speaker was Günter Reich. And Joy H. Calico's book is called Arnold Schoenberg's A Survivor from Warsaw in Post-War Europe, and it's published by the University of California Press. If you are interested in more thoughts about the playing of so-called entartete Musik, then you can find a link to our interview with the conductor John Maucheri from earlier this year, and also to his article called The Inconvenient Music. It's a subject which is one that will never go away, I suspect.